This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
I'm joined here with Mike Anisimov. He's a futurist and political writer. Mike, it's great speaking with you.
Great speaking to you, Robert.
So to start things off, you have a background in tech. You worked with the Singularity Institute, and can you give us some background information, the publications you've written for, and how you became interested in futurist in political topics, including AI and transhumanism?
All right. So way back around like 2001, I read a short article called What is Friendly AI? That was on KurzweilAI.net, which is Ray Kurzweil's website. Also around the same time, like I read The Age of Spiritual Machines when I was a teenager. So also I read Engines of Creation by Eric Drexler about nanotechnology when I was also a teenager. So at that time, I got fascinated by just the futurist and transhumanist scene, and I was one of the early people that was involved in it. And but mostly, for the most part, I just wrote this blog, Accelerating Future, that was extremely popular for a while, and at one point it was in the top 10 tech blogs. And I just wrote about like transhumanist issues and risk issues and just the AI singularity stuff. And I think I contributed one chapter to a textbook more recently, but in general, my book writing only began around 2015 or so, when I wrote a couple books. And I got into politics through people around the Singularity Institute who were reading Curtis's blog, Curtis Yarvin.
Basically the neo-reaction sphere.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just how I got into politics, and also just because of like reading interest in history for the most part. Like I always read a lot of stuff here and there, and I wasn't super politically like charged up really, because I was just a centrist Democrat for many years. And then by reading Curtis's stuff and also just reading history, I changed my political views, and I became like an anti-democrat activist, I guess you could say, like against democracy. And I've been like that I've been writing about that openly since around 2012 or so. So it's been almost a decade now.
And you're from White Russian ancestry. How far back do you trace your family in Russian history? And to what degree is that identity, is it preserved or insular? Or to what degree is it assimilated in the diaspora in the U.S., and then contrasting the White Russian community with post-Soviet immigrants? And did you see that that article from Anatoly Karlin I sent you about the different groups of Russian Americans?
Yeah, the White Russians are very insular and completely sealed off from the Russian community for the most part. Or they have their own Russian community essentially, and it doesn't really invite in newcomers from Russia into it. So my identity is very closely tied to White Russian like history and upbringing and all that. And my family has intermarried with Americans, but more in the last 15 or so years.
You're talking about people you're related to by marriage, or is your ancestry is 100% Russian?
My ancestry is pretty much 100% Russian. Like, there's a small admixture of Latvian, but it's not a heck of a lot. But yeah, I mean, my family came over in the 40s and basically was not assimilated into American groups until like the year 2000 or something. So it was pretty sealed off. And my there's white Russian blood in both sides of my family, even though like they're both sides of the family are from slightly different parts of Russia, but they're both white Russians. And there's a lot of family history around that, and just my identity and my family's identity is very much tied into that. And even though Russians are common ancestry around the world, there's like more than 100 million, the number of white Russian expats is much, much lower. So it's kind of like everyone that left Russia at the same time, they all went to like the same refugee camps. They all went to San Francisco for the most part.
Is like, there still a community in San Francisco?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's even like aristocratic functions, like there's a ball that they have and stuff that has like the entire white Russian scene in the entire country, like the elite of that attend this ball. And there's like I attended Russian school, the complete church school, and I like did a graduation with a waltz and everything. So there's still a huge community, a decent sized community of white Russians that all still just talk to each other. And the younger ones are mixing in a bit with America, but it's still like, it's possible to, in San Francisco and the Bay Area, it's possible to be in communities where you can actually just speak Russian to all the people you know, and you don't even need to necessarily interact like business-wise very deeply with Americans. It's kind of like how the Chinese are in California.
This is mostly in the Richmond district?
Yeah, exactly.
And with futurism and AI, are you interested in a specific aspect, such as radical life extension or brain augmentation?
I'm particularly interested in the self-improving AI and the smarter-than-human AI and just the smarter-than-human element of that whole thing, because I think that's the key issue, is when you create something that's smarter than human, then it changes everything else. So when it comes to like life extension, brain augmentation, or anything like that, I think that those things will be achieved fairly quickly once we actually upgrade our intelligence. And I don't think that we're going to really proceed very far in them until we have smarter than human intelligence, because some of those problems, especially brain augmentation, the complexity of it is overwhelming without assistance from enhanced intelligence.
And do you think the implementation of AI and then also genetic engineering will challenge liberal values? The inequality of implementation, of course, will be a big concern. It could exacerbate inequality, but then there's also the eugenics taboo with gene editing.
I think that liberals are just going to ban any serious interventions so that we won't see any enhancement. It won't challenge. They're going to see the risk that it poses to their worldview from a distance, and then they're going to ensure that the most radical possibilities are suppressed for as long as possible. That's the way that I view it.
And what are your thoughts on a future of abundance, thoughts on a post-scarcity economy, and do you think a fully automated luxury communism is viable?
I think that the post-scarcity depends on certain like political formulations being put into place that are very different than what we have now, because of the amount of danger that is posed by the engines of creation, like the machines that are able to create post-scarcity. They're going to be so they can be used so much for warfare that this is one of the reasons why I got into just government in general, is that the amount of government like monitoring and influence and control, and also built-in controls into these systems, the amount that will be necessary for it not to be dangerous is extreme. So I think that for the most part, first of all, I don't think that we're anywhere near post-scarcity. I think it's going to be at least maybe 80 to 100 years before we're at that level, just because of the difficulty of the technologies, their complexity, and so on. Like fully automated luxury communism, anything like that, I mean, it's going to be dependent on AI completely to create these post-scarcity scenarios. And once you create AI, it's like you're kind of like a Matrix scenario where you're creating a completely different organism. So it's kind of that challenge of creating a different organism and dealing with it is gonna be the salient issue. That's the number one issue. Like, are we gonna survive or not? That's the kind of issue that I care about the most.
Are you a supporter of the UBI?
I'm not right now because I think it's not fiscally responsible. So I think that I'm in favor of there being direct cash payments related to
the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of it is basically like pork to governments or to corporations rather than like a direct cash payouts.
Yeah, I mean, the political will to do UBI is not there, really. Like, Yang notwithstanding. And just the math of it is unattractive. Because if you do the math of how many trillions of dollars UBI goes into, it's like we have a huge budget deficit without UBI, you know? And then, to me, like, I see some right-wingers that seem to be doing the... they're going over into that MMT... what's that stand for again? Market monetary theory or whatever.
What that means is that if you put money into the economy, it stimulates the economy. So the argument is that with a UBI or direct cash payouts, like, I guess they would make the case that someone who is lower income, they would spend that money and it would go right back into the economy. Or same with even if someone's middle income. Well, if you subsidize, say, like a government institution or bureaucracy, then you're separating that from the economy. So different people might have different takes on it, but that's basically what that modern monetary theory is.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like the devaluation of the dollar since the 50s, it's concerning. And so I just think that any thing like UBI could cause a catastrophic failure of the currency. So I'm not in favor of any of the kind of like socialist elements that you see emerging a lot on the right wing right now, because I do believe, I'm not a market monetary theorist, I believe that money has value and that you can't make it out of nothing. So I don't think it'll just go back into the economy, everything will be fine. You know, everyone can have endless free money and then there won't be any consequences. I just don't think that's the way it works.
With concerns about AI leading to neo-feudalism, like, what are your thoughts on how to avoid these dystopian worst-case scenarios with AI, and then just how overall thoughts on weighing the benefits versus the harm of AI and transhumanism?
Well, I think that the transhumanism and AI are both extremely dangerous, and most people don't understand the risk involved, and they don't understand the danger. But some do. You know, there's fiction like The Matrix or whatever that might make people, but people don't take it really seriously. So, like, as far as neo-feudalism, something like that, it's all going to come down to what I worked on at the Singularity Institute, which was how to program AI that is beneficial and broadly so, and kind of acts like an operating system for Earth, essentially, because that's what it's going to be. We're eventually going to create an entity that's essentially like an operating system for Earth. So, that AI would be responsible for preventing that neo-feudalist dystopian scenario. If we create AI that's able to do that, then we'll be okay. But if we don't explicitly create an AI like that, or create an AI that is not so heavily in control, then I think like something like neo-feudalism or even more dystopian could emerge. And that all just comes down to that friendly AI problem of how to build AI in the first place.
You're a Bay Area native. Were you involved with the Bay Area futurist scene when you lived there?
Oh, yeah, very, very deeply. Yeah, very much so. So,
did you know Anatoly Karlin?
Yeah, I've met him in person. And we both lived in Berkeley at the same time around whenever he moved to Berkeley, I guess around like 2016 or so. So, yeah, we both lived around Berkeley at the same time. And, yeah, I mean, I met and the whole Bay Area futurist scene, I was very deeply involved in it. I met everyone and was just socially intertwined with it. And it was only around maybe like 2016, 2017 that I just kind of started to slowly step away from it, because I just saw a lot of people that were just too introductory-wise and weren't focused like on the most serious projects, in my view.
What would you like to see as the most serious projects?
Well, like, for instance, there was a program that a scientific program to develop a high throughput gene sequencing technology based on like electron microscopes essentially, and tagging particular bases in the DNA with like heavy metals, and then imaging those heavy metals directly, so that potentially one could like scan an entire genome in an hour or something. Like, that's the kind of project that's serious. It was funded to the tune of like $7 million by Founders Fund, and I was involved with that until it until it just failed. But it's serious projects like that that I was interested in and still am, where people are actually trying to develop new technology and not just like kind of fantasizing about immortality, because there's a lot of that where it's sort of just like you know, semi-religious, where people practice transhumanism as a religion and don't attempt to actually develop technologies. And there's a lot of that where people aren't trying to tackle specific projects because they don't know enough about it or whatever, or the projects that they would tackle to develop. Like, who, sometimes the people that are religious transhumanists do not develop the technologies that actually push transhumanism forward, and they're just kind of observers. So that's what I don't like. I like when transhumanists actually select some kind of project or task and move it forward. So we see Elon Musk doing that. I don't know to what extent he's a religious transhumanist. I almost met him once, but then like I went home instead of sticking around the office where he came by, so I just never met him.
Oh, are you familiar with the concept of a gray tribe, Scott Alexander's concept, in contrast with the red and blue, and how politically and ideologically diverse was the Bay Area futurist scene?
The I'm familiar with Scott's
thing. Scott Jakich, I attended one of his meetings in the Bay Area.
Oh yeah, yeah, I hung out and talked with Scott Jakich like 50 to 100 times. Like I used to see him in Berkeley as well, and we would both go to the same events like constantly. So he's one of the cool guys that I knew very well in the Bay Area. But let's see. So what was your original question? I forgot it. Sorry.
Oh, how ideologically diverse was it?
Oh yeah, not at all. It's completely uniform. Everyone is a lemming thought-wise. Everyone has just lukewarm neoliberal belief system going on. The gray tribe, it's all completely ideologically uniform. I guess you'd call it like a Reddit mentality. And
wouldn't gray tribe, wouldn't like HBD, human biodiversity, fall under that umbrella?
I mean, fall under the umbrella, like in terms of that's one of the things the gray tribe talks about,
yeah,
or what?
Yeah, I guess it's not really, it's sort of a loosely, the gray tribe, because it's not well organized, it's a smaller group, it's sometimes like there'll be overlap with both the red tribe and the blue tribe. So I guess with the Bay Area futurist scene would be where the gray tribe and the blue tribe overlap, same with like support for Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang sort of started out more gray tribe, and then for obviously electoral reasons he joined up with the blue tribe.
Exactly, yeah, that's why like I always saw him as the odd man out, kind of like not appealing to rank and file Democrats. That's the way that I viewed him. Like, I think that that Democrats viewed him like that too, kind of like as an outsider or something, because he's not like heavily enough ideologically invested in wokeness to the point that they expect out of their leaders. So he was always like the odd man out. And yeah, it's so sad because the gray tribe, all it tries to do is appeal to the like Democrat base, essentially. That's all, because they want to go where the power is at, and in the places that where the gray tribe lives, like the West Coast in particular, like Democrats and liberals hold all the power, institutional-wise and otherwise. So all they're trying to do is do their best to just, you know, with the Democrats, they jump, they say how high, and that's just all they're about, is just trying to appease Democrats. But they aren't liked by Democrats in the same way that Democrats like just ideological leftists. You know, they're too, like, when Democrats see, like, intellectual types or brainy types, they think racism. They think that these people are all racist, which they kind of are, and they don't have any meaningful exposure to Hispanics or blacks either, the gray tribe, so.
I think there was a statistics that Anatoly posted, Anatoly Karlin, but it's maybe mostly white, and then maybe 20% Asian.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's what the elite of the Bay Area pretty much is that same exact demographic breakdown, like 80% white, 20% Asian. And that's just, and they fancy themselves as inclusive because they're 20% Asian, you know?
You grew up in San Mateo County, and then you also lived in Walnut Creek and Berkeley?
Yeah.
Are specific Bay Area suburbs linked to one particular industry, and how insular are these upper-class white suburbs, like, geographically segregated, and do you think economic elitism is a substitute for ethnocentrism, and how sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to, like, ethnically segregated groups, I think, like, the Bay Area elite is way, way up there, because there's no Hispanics in tech, for the most part. There aren't. And there's no blacks, even outside of tech, really, that much, except for Oakland. So every Bay Area suburb, every Bay Area elite community is different. They're all, like, just little walled cities, and the social networks are very difficult to penetrate for outsiders, and the requirement to gain admission is tons of money. So multi-million dollar homes, and just being extremely wealthy, that's the only way to get in there. So over time, the most of the people that live in the outlying suburbs are connected to the area, like have been there for some time, like their parents have or their grandparents or something.
So do you still have like a kind of like an old wealth, you still have these like old wealth white communities that they're able to maintain wealth intergenerationally going back pretty far, and the same families live in the same area? Because I'm from LA, and pretty much everything is all like new wealth.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's nouveau riche in San Francisco in particular, but it's kind of like the throughput of people going in and out is all happening in San Francisco. It's not happening in the outlying suburbs. The outlying suburbs, see, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but some people are. Like around the 70s to the 80s, the land was very cheap in the Bay Area, so anyone like that bought in around that time, kind of like their economic legacy is continuing on now.
Oh, yeah, that's why, like, well, this is the same in Southern California, too, but, like, a lot of these, like, well-off suburbs are just all boomers.
Yeah, and it's so, they're all old, and a lot of the younger folks, some of them do stick around and maintain the intergenerational wealth, but I'd say maybe, like, half of them move away. So it's kind of like, it's very old people there, mainly. Like, if you go to San Carlos or Belmont or somewhere like that in San Mateo County or San Mateo, and you just look on the street, just you see a lot of old people.
My observation last time I was in the Bay Area is Marin County is probably like the oldest, but then the wealthier parts of like Central Contra Costa, you do see more young families.
Oh, Central, I see. Yeah, I mean,
you like where you lived. You said you lived
in Walnut area. Creek.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very old, but there are more families because, like, the way that Walnut Creek and Concord are both part of the same basin, essentially. Like, Concord is where people can actually afford to buy homes who don't have a ton of money. So, like, the Walnut Creek demographics blend into the whole, like, Concord situation, which is kind of like a lower-class area. But because it's part of the same basin, there is, like, there's circulation between the individuals, the people, and there's more young families that can afford to buy new homes in that whole East Bay situation. But then when it comes to, like, the peninsula and Marin, it's completely insular. It's not like that because there's no geographic connection to any poor communities from Marin. You know, like, there's one area in Marin where there's poor people live, like, it's one tiny area in San Rafael or whatever, but and in the Bay, in the peninsula, it's just like East Palo Alto, pretty much. And then, like, some parts of San Mateo aren't super, super wealthy, but for the most part, it's just, it's extremely insulated in Marin and San Mateo because they don't even have, there's no poor communities to be seen, you know, for the most part. There's no poor people to be seen. They just don't exist there.
Yeah, I mean, there is this big exodus with remote work. As far as those, like, areas, like, which areas do you see as most susceptible to, like, demographic change?
Well, right now, like, I lived in the Sunset District for, like, 10 years, and while I was there, it was still, like, going through the process of becoming, I guess you could call it, like, Sinoification or something.
Silicon Valley, like, places like Cupertino, went from, like, an upper-middle-class white community to mostly Asian.
Yeah, it's the same thing, like, in Foster City, where, but with respect to Indians, and Foster City, where Oracle is, or near where Oracle is, where just the entire community went from white to Indian in, like, 30 years. And the same thing's happening in the Sunset District, where just, I knew many hundreds of individuals living in San Francisco, but out of all of the many hundreds of people I knew, today, I'd only say, like, a very small handful started their own families there.
There's, like, a shift in where immigrants are coming from, and then you have to kind of factor in remote work, shifting around these demographic trends.
Yeah, I mean, remote work, for the most part, is something that is engaged in by, like, well-established white folks, as far as I know, in the Bay Area. So they might have some freedom to move to the suburbs, but the question is, does the pay from the remote work have enough, like, heft to it financially for them to be to stay and to live? I don't know. Like, as far as the Bay Area, I think that it's kind of like they want you to be there in the office and be engaged, and it's not replaced by remote work for the most part, because I think that it's in industries that aren't as crucial where remote work is possible, but in industries where there's a lot of money involved, a lot of programming, and the tons of venture capital money that's funding it, remote work is frowned upon unless it's for, like, contractors or for, like, the lowest people who are lower on the rungs of things, whereas anyone with any responsibility has to be there in person. That's my impression.
Do you see these wealthier white communities maintaining their communities, or do you see them as susceptible to change several decades from now?
I think that they're completely stable, and they have some new people from immigration, but not really, like, especially Marin and the Peninsula. Like, there's some article or some paper, I forget what it is, that kind of, like, projects the demographic change for the Bay Area in the next 30 years, and for the most part, like, it might involve the, like, minority, like, particularly Hispanic community increasing by, like, to the tune of, like, 5 to 10% over, like, 20 or 30 years. So it's kind of like, and even in San Francisco, there's no projected increase in the minority community. None. So it's kind of like that's where the hypocrisy of it all comes in, because the elite Democrats, the limousine liberals, they have a completely ethnically homogeneous, except for Asians, in small numbers, and they're completely inculcated into white culture, the Asians that are there. But they're so homogeneous and they're so isolated because they have economic power, which they use to maintain their standard of living, which means ethnic homogeneity. But they advocate policies that involve, like, diversification, but they're never subject.
Economic elitism is a substitute for ethnic exclusion, for sure. And, yeah, I see most of the really rapid demographic change. I mean, California basically went through its transition in the 90s. It's more in these, like, red states, places like Texas, Georgia, North Carolina.
Yeah, I think, like, the situation of California is also, like, the future of places like Texas, where even though, like, it's not as possible to geographically isolate yourself in Texas because there's not the, you know, like, the particular geography that California and the Bay has, but still it's the same, like, model that's going to be followed, where people are going to create economically exclusive communities, and they're just able to, they can pay lip service to diversity while not having to deal with it, which is for the poorer people. The poorer people deal with the diversity, but the wealthy people completely seal themselves off and completely all white except for some Asians. But I think that's happening nationwide, actually. The whole ethnoburb situation, the whole, like, ethnic sorting is happening nationwide. So what you see in California is going to be the template for all these areas that seem diverse now, but they're in the process of sorting themselves out into ethnoburbs.
Yeah, I see that actually I see like white people doing that probably in the future. It will just be like they'll form their own version of an ethnoburb instead of thinking of themselves as part of, like, the greater society.
Yeah, because it's just about, like, the behavior, like the personal behavior in terms of like interactions and conversations and just the way that people interact with one another, like that becomes codified into a certain like etiquette, set of etiquette and a certain way of operating. And Californians are completely separate from like New Yorkers or any other Easterners when it comes to that. I'm sure you're familiar with that phenomenon.
Oh yeah, for sure. But also like the sort of like the dream of the left is everyone blending together as like one human race. But I see actually the opposite happening. It's more like a big increase in a sort of mating. Like you will see a lot of white men marrying Asian women who maybe meet in university, and the same sort of economic niche. Like you see that happening, but they have shared kind of cultural values. And then they'll raise their kids in those values, but a sort of mating, that's like the trend.
Exactly. And the number one, like intelligence is one of the number one things that people look for in a spouse, and money, obviously. So you can't make a ton of money unless you have a certain kind of way of doing things. And the elite Californian whites are similar to the elite Chinese in the way that they interact and operate and like what they're interested in and what they consider acceptable and all that stuff. The elite Chinese and the elite California whites are very in accord with a lot of that, so that's why they obviously intermarry.
Ed Dutton, he had a talk about his new book, like an HBD type book, and he was saying that there, like in Hawaii, there's a lot of intermarriage, but he was saying like the Japanese, there's just something about the white people in Hawaii and the Japanese community, they're very, very compatible, so like mixing does happen, but it creates kind of new tribal identities, and so sort of this dream of the left of like a blended humanity, and then it's maybe the worst, it's a dystopian vision for some people on the right, but it's just not going to happen.
Mixing into one race, yeah. Obviously, it's not happening. Yeah, because you can't fake income, you know? So it's like people don't want to marry down. So why would they diversify when the people, you know, of a swarthy complexion don't make enough money? That's the way that they look at it.
What made you leave California? Because where you lived was pretty nice. Was this, you were in Berkeley for a while, which is more urban, and then you moved out to the suburbs. Was it economic reasons?
Yeah, it's economic reasons because of raising a family, basically. Like, it's not, there was no future for a family for me and my view in the Bay Area, and just it's all played out, the whole Bay Area, and you can't make money there unless you're extremely highly educated. I dropped out of college and I'm happy with that decision, and I just didn't want to jump through the various hoops that you need to get into that wealthy California niche. So yeah, I just wanted to see the other parts of the country, and I got extremely sick of California because it's so ideologically uniform and it's so liberal. And that and economic reasons, I was completely sick of the Bay Area by the time I left. And places like the Sunset where I grew up, they're completely changed. You know, it's just there are so many Chinese there, and it's not the community that it was. And all, like, I think it was on your show with Peter Nimitz, you said like that California whites are the most individualistic or socially atomized people on the planet. You know, and it's just that goes completely against, you know, all my desires for what I want out of life. And as soon as I moved out of California, I basically moved to an area that's just kind of like more normal America. And I like it so much more than the whole California, like, mind programming situation. It's just the amount of conformity that is demanded in California ideologically is just too much for me.
So you were in Florida and in Idaho.
I'm not living in Idaho yet. I've only just visited. I just plan to move there eventually, but before I go to Idaho, I'm just going to move to different parts of the East and Midwest just to kind of like meet different people and just experience different parts of the country.
I mean, Florida, I can see that for the quality of life, but it's just all kind of flat. Like the one, like where you are, even in the Bay Area, like you, even though it's urban, you do have all these mountain areas you can hike. Even near Berkeley and Walnut Creek. Berkeley is sort of like the center. It's associated with the most extreme woke left, but the one thing I do really like about it is just one of the few places where you have the real contrast between urbanism, but just going a little bit of inland from Berkeley into like Tilden Park, and then further out into Contra Costa, you still have so much like wilderness, And you don't really get that same contrast in L.A.
No, yeah, I don't know how people can stand L.A. I guess they go to the San Gabriel Mountains or whatever. Would you say that that's where people go?
Yeah, but it's not really comparable. I guess the Santa Monica Mountains, going to the hiking in the Santa Monica Mountains near Malibu in the Pacific Palisades, would be the equivalent of going from like from Berkeley to go for a hike in Tilden Park or Briones or Mount Diablo, like those kind of places.
I've been to all those places many times. Like, I love Briones, I love Tilden, and I've hiked like every single hill in the Bay Area, and I know many of the unique like views that most people aren't familiar with, like especially in Belmont and San Carlos. And I love the nature so much.
The microclimates too.
Yeah, microclimates, and just especially like Burlingame, where I'm from, it's kind of like that. There's a near Crystal Springs Reservoir. There's like a really decent sized hill range, which completely blocks.
I haven't hiked there, but I do notice whenever I take the highway to SF, I do see that reservoir from the highway.
Yeah, I love. That's one of my favorite places to hike. And my parents have been hiking there since like the 70s, and the way that there's a mountain range there blocks the cold air from the ocean from going into San Mateo County. So it's like that's why Burlingame and Redwood City have the perfect climates, because they have that California warmth. But a problem with a lot of the California coast is that it's incredibly cold and foggy. You even see that all the way up in Eureka and places like that. Not L.A., but anywhere like Central California,
going north. Even Santa Monica in L.A. can get fogged in like June, early summer.
It can, okay, yeah. But you know, like how what was it, Walt Whitman or whoever said like the coldest?
Mark Twain, yeah.
Mark Twain, okay.
The coldest winter was a summer in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like that. That's why anyone with a lot of money is trying to move into the either Marin or the peninsula, because it doesn't have that cold fog going on.
Do you have any thoughts on the current political situation? Thoughts on why you initially supported Trump? And I mean, now a lot of people in our sphere are extremely critical of him. And what happened towards the end of just the role he played in contributing, like whether he contributed to a lot of this like civil unrest. And then just how ridiculous it is, like all these pardons he gave to rappers and white collar criminals, but nothing really like anti-establishment, and just overall like Trump's legacy. Thoughts on the current political situation and the election of Biden?
No, I'm completely thrilled by the election of Biden, because I didn't think it was going to happen. So the fact that it did, I couldn't be happier, and that's for like accelerationist reasons for the most part. Because it's the whole like complacency that was created by Trump that we get so tired of. And also the critiques that we started posing of Trump like maybe a year or so into his term, all of them came true. You know, all the accusations that we leveled at him have all been proven and demonstrated, and we were right.
Yeah, I would actually say he's made things worse, because positions that anything to do with nationalism, populism, immigration restriction are associated with Trump, and just all that nonsense, all these people who are carrying water for him, and all the nonsense about trusting the plan, and it's sort of the worst. Yeah, it's the worst of both worlds, because Trump is had fairly conventional normie conservative policies, but now there's this, with the crackdown, it's being treated like being a Trump supporter is like the equivalent of being like a neo-Nazi.
Yeah, I mean, he did shift the Overton window initially, but he didn't build that much new wall. Like, the main thing I wanted out of him was wall, and he couldn't, you know, do that, and he didn't push hard enough in the first 2 years. So it's like, the one reason why I mainly supported him was for the wall, but that just never happened.
Like, the immigration issue, it seems to be kind of like a losing battle, but with Biden, yeah, I do think it's better. Like, it's better to have like a clear idea of like this neoliberal opposition rather than dealing with like the bullshit under Trump.
Yeah, and just the white Americans are way too fat and happy, and they aren't doing anything to take control or better their own situation, and when Trump just allows them all to be completely lazy because then he's the one that's going to supposedly do everything, but he hasn't done anything. And this is going to continue to be a problem, this Trump thing. Like, he's going to continue to have supporters and proxies and his daughter, and it's just going to go on and on and on because he has so many supporters, and they're going to keep supporting him.
Because it seems like it's a cult of personality. Like, they're almost like worshiping Trump, and it just feel like there's these different kind of religious revivals, like same with the woke politics, but it's more like a cult of personality behind Trump than part of any kind of greater populist nationalist movement.
Yeah, completely. And also it just allows people to buy into democracy and believe that their vote matters, and it just, you know, it plugs people back into the system again, and that's really what the legacy of Trump is going to be, where the right wing thinks that they could do anything through the electoral system, but I hope that Biden and Kamala will disabuse everyone of those ideas by cracking down on the Capitol protester type people and like that. So I'm just hoping that Biden and Kamala go too far and spur a backlash.
Yeah, there could be like a... Yeah, as opposed to, generally does seem like the kind of frog in the boiling pot theory, but like how far do you see Biden and Kamala Harris pushing?
You know, I'm just hopeful that they push really far, but I don't believe they'll be that easy, so I'm cautious about it. Because I think at heart, Biden is a neoliberal centrist, obviously. You know, like he was friends with all the racist senators.
Yeah.
So he's not... But he's so old and kind of, you know, I don't know to what extent, like, he doesn't have a cult of personality like Trump does, and I don't think that he's as strong and assertive of an independent decision maker as, so I think that he might be controlled by Kamala, and that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Biden. I mean, Biden's pretty moderate, but the forces, like, things like extreme wokeness and anti-whiteness are so strong.
Yeah, like I've been satisfied by his cabinet choices for the most part, because it seems like he's throwing red meat to the far left a little bit. But when it comes down to it, like reviewing his executive orders, he's already done like 30 executive orders, and I read them all, like, you know, what they do, whatever. And he immediately reneged on abolishing student loan debt, you know?
Oh yeah, even like he's going to put, like, Tubman on the 20, but he's not going to do the 2000. So that, I mean, that's peak, like, neoliberalism. But, yeah, I think it's pretty much, like, standard kind of neoliberal policies. So you'd say overall you identify more, you have a more aristocratic rather than a populist outlook.
Yeah, completely. So the whole, like, right populism thing is, like, they're really trying to push it on the far right now. Because of the money, you know, the $2,000 that we're supposed to be owed or whatever. But I don't think that that's going to enable, like, a movement into right populism, because I think it's just the whole, like, getting money from the government thing is just temporary and contingent on the pandemic. So I don't think that the economic policies of right populism make financial sense, and I don't think that they're implementable either. I think that they would cause economic collapse if they were implemented, and that also that it won't be possible because there's too much dependence on big business in America, the way that it's been built up. You can't just make it socialist. You can't just change it and make it more socialist. So I don't think, because it doesn't respond that way. All the economic systems are based on cutthroat capitalism and will continue to be, and you can't socialize that. It's too... Without, like, revolution, but the left isn't going to stage one, so it's just I think the right populism economic thing is just a symptom of the moment of opportunity created by the pandemic, and while people are going to continue to keep pushing it, like Huey Long and the whole Huey Long thing, you know, like Tucker mentioned Huey Long or whatever, I don't think that it's going to get traction, so I'm not really concerned about it in the long term. I don't think it's even worth fighting against for the most part. I just think that we should let it play out, and then we'll just go back to normal.
I mean, with the big crackdown online against the right, what are your thoughts on the viability of alt-tech?
Of alt tech?
Yeah, alt tech.
Oh, I think the alt tech is doing great right now because of the Twitter crackdown, you know? So we're seeing a lot of development in that space. And things like Brave, you know, the browser, was successful. And that's one area where there is continued motion and continued investment is in this whole alt tech thing. And I don't think the crackdown is going to be able to stop it. So the most, like, these crackdowns, for the most part, tend to be performative, and they don't actually stop people from doing what they're going to do. That's my impression of them.
I mean, right now, regarding, like, with Biden representing more kind of a, he represents more like a neoliberal centrism rather than the far left, but deplatforming is now Antifa and prominent leftists are being deplatformed, suspended from social media, and you kind of see these two forces, like what happened last year, last summer with the civil unrest, like you have Black Lives Matter versus Antifa, like the end of an alliance, and then one side is one side, like the kind of radical leftists who want to dismantle capitalism and defund the police, they're radically anti-American, and then the other side who basically wants to maintain the current system but with more racial quota set asides.
Yeah, like when it comes to the whole racial equity movement or motion from Biden, it's going to be purely performative.
I think he'll do a lot in that, but it will be basically like neoliberalism plus more affirmative action, but nothing like radically leftist.
No, yeah, exactly. So it's like there won't be a enemy for us all to unite against. Like even Obama was a better enemy. So if that's why like the progress on the right is going to be slow, because there is no enemy yet to really unite against, and no one is afraid of socialism.
I'm neither a fan of Obama, nor did I ever have like Obama derangement syndrome. I think he was a pretty generic neoliberal, even if you look at immigration crackdowns, there were more deportations. And I don't think he was that extreme as how like the right were portraying him at the time, but it would be interesting to see, like, Kamala Harris does seem, she does seem to be like pretty radically anti-white. I would say far more than Obama was.
Yeah, I think like the way that she is so anti-white is creating a moment of opportunity for our side, and the way that things are playing out towards ethnic segregation or separation. So I think it's going to do a lot of good in terms of driving that, especially like if they do anything with regard to housing, any like housing-related initiatives. Like Obama at one point like had a huge database where he was trying to break down the ethnic divisions of suburbs so that
I don't think he actually implemented that, but that was an idea, but that would kind of shake things up, because you have all these kind of upper middle class white liberal suburbanites who are able to sort of benefit from the status quo that would sort of force them to challenge their positions.
Yeah, exactly. So, but right now they're so powerful and separated from any change related to like equity or racial equity coming from the government.
Looking at the nation as a whole and this like extreme polarization, I don't really see like collapse theory, because if you look back at history, like Rome took at least 2 centuries to fall. It's more kind of just feels like a kind of gradual stagnation. So the U.S. will exist as a political and economic zone, but I think what is dying out is sort of Americanism as an idea of being people identifying as America, like the myth of America being undermined by extreme polarization, and you're seeing a lot of like your European Americans identifying as like a stateless people.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's changing a little bit slowly, step by step, but I don't know. You know, it depends. It's all also dependent. I think the pandemic, any like risk, any like anything that shows the reality of scarcity or creates challenges, all anything like that makes people more tribalistic. So that is what you are seeing with some. Some liberals are actually, like, people vote for Trump even in San Francisco, you know? Like, and people vote for Trump in L.A. too. Like, it might be just 15% or 20%, but it's still, there's people there, even in the, you know, the citadels of progressivism that are conservative or right wing.
Even if, like, I think I showed you the article I wrote in UNS, the areas that rejected affirmative action in California, LA, and the Bay Area. But even a lot of areas that voted for Biden, obviously Asian areas, but a lot of upper middle, white upper middle class suburbs too.
Yeah, tons, exactly. And that, like, nuance that me and you understand as Californians, where it's not like Californians are, like, all communists.
Oh, yeah, like, and my own articles, like, I didn't really get, one of the comments is, like, I don't, like, they're all California shitlibs, like, I don't care about, there's no, like, no nuance.
Yeah, the people aren't interested in, like, breaking it down, but, you know, when it comes to, like, performance art of equity, Californians love that, but when it comes to their pocketbook, then suddenly the attitude changes.
Yeah, like, I did notice a correlation between areas that were more family-oriented and opposing affirmative action, even if they're Democrats.
Yeah, and there's people that might, like, give speeches about diversity to their colleagues, but then go to the voting booth and vote against affirmative action.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And even, I think with, like, there are, like, true believers in wokeness, but I think, a lot of the ultra-wealthy actually have more right-wing values, in a sense. They're thinking in terms of passing down, like, a birthright to their descendants.
Yeah, and they all view the whole, like, left-wing politics as a tool to accomplish their goals.
Yeah,
it's instrumental.
Sure. And I think I'd say, like, among corporate CEOs, like, there's probably like, the true believers, and then those who are just more cynical, just going along with it because it's safer for business.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the economic strategy of diversity is to basically want to be able to use the skills of high IQ people from any culture. Like, that's what Google is, right? Like, they have high IQ Indians, high IQ Chinese, high IQ white people, and so on. So it's good for business to be able to accept those people from the whole globe. So all the best computer scientists on the globe, whatever their race, can contribute to help making money for Google. You know, so, but then that's where the diversity stops. It does not extend to blacks or Hispanics.
Yeah, like, merit-based immigration, but they're not serious about any kind of, like, redistribution of wealth to these, like, lower-income minority communities. Or, like, even with, like, affirmative action, it's more symbolic if it's giving a job to someone who's already made it into the middle class, but they're not serious about investing into the poor, like, large amounts of money that will impact the elite's pocketbook.
Yeah, exactly. And if you just look, like, at the wealth inequality in the Bay Area of, like downtown San Jose versus downtown Walnut Creek are completely, like, different planets.
The geographic barriers, like, with the Bay and the mountains and hills, make it more extreme than L.A. even. Because L.A., everything, like, if you go from Beverly Hills to East L.A., it's all in one basin.
Exactly, and also that's why, like, someone like me, when I go to L.A., like, I find it to be, like, really kind of, like, dirty, I guess you could say, like, rough and dirty, because it's all that one same basin.
L.A. is, like, places, like, further out, Orange County and Ventura, but it's much more geographically distanced, because Oakland and Walnut Creek feel totally different, but they're relatively close. Like, for L.A., you'd have to drive pretty far from Central LA to say, like, Thousand Oaks or Orange County.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why the Bay Area elite can have their cake and eat it, too, is because they have that economic separation going.
Yeah, same with school districts. LA, all of LA is in one school district, LA Unified, and the Bay Area is broken up into a bunch of smaller school districts, so that matters, too. And then that gets into the whole, like, that's a big obsession with the woke left, is diversifying public schools.
Yeah, but then when you live, like, in even, like, North Berkeley or somewhere, you don't have to deal with diversification of your public school, because it's kind of like the people that are really diverse don't have the money to go to the schools that are really nice.
I mean, my thoughts on the future of the United States politically is, you'll have one side, which is the more the establishment position of, it will be a kind of version of civic nationalism based on an American imperialism, based on liberalism, and the loyalty to institutions, the state, corporations, wokeness, And then the opposition will probably be some kind of neo-tribal pluralism that is friendlier maybe towards a kind of decentralized version of socialism.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's still many tribalistic people that aren't socialistic at all. Because, like, Trump supporters in particular, some of them do take, like, the anti-socialism thing fairly seriously. I think, like, that it's going to be more like the red states are actually unifying around their own separate identity.
Yeah, just a kind of overall decline in trust of institutions, building up community social capital, that providing people's economic needs, that will be like a change in thinking just because the main institutions are, they're not working for as many people, but I think like if there is like a massive, if massive numbers of like Trump supporters are losing their jobs for their views, if that happens in a large mass, then that would actually change the mindset. But there's generally still a mentality, I mean, it hasn't really gone to this point where, but there's still a mentality where people's economic needs are provided for by either the state or by large corporations.
Yeah, for the most part. But the whole like cracking down on Trump supporters thing, it might make it so that parallel institutions will be created, but we're not there yet.
And that's the thing with like pushing. I think if they push so hard, that would happen. But I don't really see. I see these kind of like we had after the Capitol Hill riots, there was a wave of deplatforming, and then kind of things calmed down a bit. Then going back to basically the status quo of the frog in the bowling pan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of anyone who has been investigated as a result of the Capitol thing. I think like it's mainly limited to the people that went in the building. I think there's one charge or something that was, I think they put up one charge against one guy who was outside the building thus far. So that's where they're at now with the whole Capitol thing. It's like, they're not doing a broad crackdown like how the, you know, the KGB or, and the Soviets or whatever
yeah,
would have done.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think, like, a lot of Trump supporters have a bit of a martyr complex where they think that they're all going to be thrown around. Like, they literally think they're going to be thrown into gulags. But I think what happens,
yeah.
I think the people involved with the riots, like, many of them are being prosecuted. And people who openly and promoted it have been deplatformed, but I think Trump supporters exaggerate like the degree that they're this massive, they probably exaggerate how bad it will be. I think it will probably just
yeah.
go back to the kind of like the gradual decline, the frog in the bowling pan theory.
Yeah, it's going to be like the Obama years again for
yeah.
the most part, as far as
Could
and
well
the, yeah, all the people that riled up the crowd, like Nick and Alex Jones and Ali Alexander, none of them are going to face any charges.
Do you think that just the people who engaged in actual violence are going to prison?
Yeah, like anyone that set foot within the Capitol, sure. And they're all documented, too. So, you know, it doesn't even require, like, deep investigation. It's just there's a stream that has everyone
people,
on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the people who filmed themselves, like, in the office, in the politicians' offices, yeah, those people for sure.
Yeah. And even then, like Baked Alaska or whatever, I think he's going to get like a slap on the wrist.
A lot of it also depends on how the economy is impacted by COVID. If there'll be a kind of recovery and we'll go back to, I mean, we're not going to see a booming economy, of course, but we could just see an economic recovery and just a continuation of stagnation and greater income inequality. Basically, a continuation of the 2010s. But I'm not really sure if we're going to see like a real full-on economic crash.
Yeah, no, because especially like with the way that the fundamentals were doing so well before COVID, like it kind of surprised me that the economy was going so well at that time, because it seemed like there is a slow decline, and I thought, you know, maybe there won't be prosperity again, and there'll be 2% max GDP growth per year going forward. But now, like, I really don't know, because the economy was doing so well, almost full employment before COVID, that maybe, like, 3, 4, 5% GDP growth is possible, like, several years down the road. But I think the economic consequences from COVID are going to last for several years.
You have a book, Idaho Project. So is this advocating, you talk about, is this basically enclavism, building up enclaves or economically resilient and high trust communities?
Yeah, I think that the rise in ethnoburbs essentially is like a more mild version of what I talk about in the book.
Yeah, so,
people are doing that like on their own without, you know, me encouraging them.
I mean, I see the future is you have kind of like Americanism, and then you also have people who talk about like building new countries from scratch, which is pretty, I mean, that's totally unrealistic, and I don't think it's great optics either. I just see the future is basically emulating the model of like immigrant enclaves or ethnoburbs. That's the future, and it could be in a rural area or it could be in the suburb of a major metro.
Yeah, but there's certain like needs legally wise that white Americans will have to push for in order to like say for instance like if the Obama housing thing actually like kicked in for real, then white Americans would need to use legal means to defend themselves. But they wouldn't, so, you know, they might pass laws. They wouldn't be overtly racial-oriented laws, but it would be economic laws that have the same consequences, that basically prevent them from being subject to, like, forced integration.
Yeah, and I don't think that the mainstream right has been really thinking in those terms. They're mostly just thinking in terms of Americanism.
Yeah, that's why like I'm encouraging people to think more like along lines of separate things, like even if not its own country, just more legal independence. And I'm hoping like that the crackdown against Trump types is going to help facilitate that.
Very well could be, but it depends like how far it goes. I think like that's what happens in the past. I think was sent with crackdowns. It goes in these waves, and then things kind of come back and go back to the status quo. We're at the end of the show. Mike, do you have any projects, upcoming projects that you want to plug or any other, or a website?
I'm going to announce that I'm almost done with a book on the alt-right. It's like 350 or so pages, and I'm almost just wrapping it up. So just stay tuned for that, and I go into almost every major issue related to the alt-right and just a little bit of the history of how it got started and kind of just creating a work that just sums up my view of the formation of the alt-right and how that happened and how it's continuing.
And do you have a website?
Not right now, no. Don't have a website at the moment. I will eventually. It'll be connected to the book when the book is announced.
Mike Anisimov, it's been an excellent show, and thanks for being on.
All right, thank you, Robert.